Hello and welcome to Dialect. Welcome to Dialect for the week beginning 18th March 2012. I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman. This week we have two Davids, one from London and one from Bristol, and both are fairly public-minded people. David Wetzel is a former bus conductor who rose to chair the Transport Committee and revolutionised London transport. Our other David is David Parks, and he wants to transform Bristol's living space.
We've got the second part of Anthea Page's visit to Northern Ireland, where she visits Shankill Road. Malcolm Grieve reads Lady Stanhope's diary. She's the niece of William Pitt, and she's off to Syria. We've got some poetry with Rosemary Dunn, and Jeff Sparks gives us the What's On Guide. Dialect is produced by volunteers and is broadcast in Bristol on BCFM 93.2. It's also on Swindon FM, Preston FM, and St Albans on Radio Verulam. If you want to join in, contacting Volunteering Bristol, and we'll give you the number for the end of the show. It's just off Queen Square for those of you who are in Bristol. Dialect recommends the volunteer-run Bristol Bullywatch helpline, aimed mainly at school children and parents. The number is 01454 318 753, and we'll have a reminder of phone numbers for both Volunteering Bristol and Bullywatch at the end of the show.
It's my pleasure to introduce David Parks to the studio. Hello.
Hello, John.
And you're here to talk about sustainability.
Yes.
Yes. What is your interest in sustainability, and how long has this been going on in your life generally?
Well, sustainability is one of two very overused generic words, the other being community,
right.
Both of which we use a lot in the context of the project I'm involved with, which is to try and provide a vision of a new community down in South Bristol,
okay,
in Bedminster Knoll. And the idea being that we have the opportunity, because of a site that used to be a college, rather than seeing that simply developed for housing, is to bring forward something that's bottom-up, responds to the Localism Act and the government's idea of big society, but has also the opportunity to provide affordable housing and sustainable living.
I was going to say, this sounds just like the kind of thing David Cameron probably really would like to see himself associated with. Wonderful. I mean, all the logistics of that must be a nightmare, and we will come to that in a moment. But I wonder first if perhaps we can go into some of what the dream or the vision itself is about. Describe where this is. Where is this campus? How has this become available?
Well, the site is the old Marksby Road site of the City of Bristol College. We've now moved to splendid new premises in Hengrove. And the site, therefore, has some marvellous facilities. It has a sports hall. It has an old school, which we hope to reoccupy as a school. We have a range of other facilities on the site, which are currently being used by an organisation called ArtSpace, who are well known in Bristol.
Oh, ArtSpace LifeSpace.
ArtSpace LifeSpace. Okay. So it's now the ArtSpace LifeSpace College, and they took over temporary use of the property. And I've done a few things with ArtSpace and the Invisible Circus.
Yeah.
So I turned up thinking, well, how can I help? Maybe I can cook. And I saw this space, and I just thought, well, the thought of them handing over the keys to Persimmon or Barrett for all that to be flattened and just a Arcacia Avenue housing estate to rise in its wake.
So everybody was thinking it would probably just be sold off to the highest bidder and then just build a whole new council estate.
Yeah.
Okay.
And why would we build a housing estate in the middle of a big housing estate?
Well, it's a very good question, but so, perhaps we should be asking a plan of that, because I have no idea.
And what I realised, because my background is in development. I was involved, amongst others, in horrendous schemes like Harbourside. And you just start to think, well, heaven's sake, we have to do better than that.
Okay.
And what development can do, of course, is it can suck all the value out of community, in that value goes to the landowner or the developer and leaves very little, particularly when you're building standard conventional housing, left for the community. So in the priority regeneration area, we have not a lot of good infrastructure. What we have, we need to maintain. But this, because of its size, gives us huge potential to really create something special. And that could be a size of maybe 600, 700, 800, maybe more people living in this community and owning the land. That's the proposition.
Let's go back to a word that you used there, and that was infrastructure. There isn't a lot of infrastructure. And I almost just wonder, I think, well, okay, bus routes, what else do we mean? What does that mean, infrastructure? What is lacking in a community?
This isn't Stokes Croft, and it's not North Street Bedminster. We don't have shops, a lot of shops here. In fact, there isn't a supermarket close by, and there is not a lot of social or community infrastructure in this area.
Okay, so you know, nowhere for teenagers to go, nobody to really develop themselves outside of just going to work and then coming home again.
No. No, and we have people working within the ArtSpace LifeSpace College, such as Andre, who set up a skateboard park there, who now has 700 members, and that's a fantastic part of that community.
Andre Seedlin, yes, I know.
Yeah, so clearly there's a demand for that, and clearly the community there don't want to simply see this infrastructure lost.
Okay, so we've already got quite a wide encompassing vision that could ever rapidly expand. Let's ground it in some reality. So potentially this property just could have got sold off to the highest bidder. How have you managed to sort of stop this happening?
Well, it was last year due to be put out to tender and is still under threat to go out to tender. But yes, we arrived and we started to have a dialogue with the landowners and with the local community and raise some support. We have 750 people now on our who've supported this on through the website, through the BS3 campus website, and started to make some noise. We put a vision onto the website. We produced a plan, courtesy of an architect who gave their time for nothing. We have no funds. So we started to think about, okay, well, if we're building a community on this scale, what's that mean? And that's a really interesting question. And so we tried to bring in people from different areas of the local community, house builders, self-builders, people from St. Werburgh's self-built project.
Okay, so we're talking about affordable housing as well as all of the community infrastructure.
Absolutely,
all in one. It's yes. Almost like a, well, never mind, talk about a big society, it's almost like a mini society all of its own you seem to be trying to develop.
Well, I think that's the aspiration. On this scale, this has not been done in the UK. So we take inspiration from, for example, a project in Germany at Freiburg, which is 5,000 people. That was built bottom-up, with most of that community being involved in the design, planning, and build of their homes. So, you know, that's an inspiring place. And that's a place where the Bristol City Council and the University of West of England went on a study tour. And we're saying, look, rather than leaving that report gathering dust, let's rake that down and use that as a great model.
Okay, so who actually currently owns this land?
The land's owned by three public sector landowners, the City Council, the Homes and Community Agency, and Knightstone Housing.
Okay, because that makes me think there is other areas in Bristol where lands are owned by a mixture of people, and that almost invariably means that it's incredibly difficult to come to some kind of consensus because the three groups may have different ideas about what they want.
Well, in this case, they've come together and got a consensus that they want to sell it.
Well, that's brilliant. Okay, but how do you
fight
against...
Which is good and bad.
How do you fight against, you know, Mammon? Like, what's going to stop them just selling it to the highest bidder?
Yeah, that is the question. Well, we have stopped them in that... Well, we've had certainly a part in that. In that, you know, we are still in the game. They've encouraged us to bid. Why wouldn't they? Seeking a community bid. But of course, there is a huge question as to how we get credibility, capacity together.
So you've certainly got a few hundred people.
We do have a lot of professionals. We do have some great support. We have some great delivery partners. And we've said that rather than this being handed over to one company, commercial company like Barrett's Persimmon, whoever, let's create a partnership. And we have some great friends who have real resources to bring to be part of that partnership.
Okay.
So that's what we're intending to put forward.
Could people sort of come along and see what you're doing or get involved? What's happening sort of now?
Well, I'm down there tomorrow. You're very welcome, John. Come and have a look at the site tomorrow. I'm down there meeting some people to show them around the site. The site is Art Spaces at the moment, so you can go in there at any point and see what's going on there.
Right.
And there is an awful lot going on there, as you can imagine. But we are building consensus. We have a community company now formed, a community interest company, and we have within that company a range of skills and a range of people from the local community, as I said, self-builders and professionals.
Okay, so and
myself.
How can people, if they want to sort of say, well, I want to support this and put my hand up, how can they do that?
Go to the website, BS3 Campus, through Google. We'll take you to the website or look us up on Facebook. And there's the opportunity to sign up on a petition there or ask a question or get involved or contact me in person.
Okay, well, for this week at least, thank you very much for coming in. And that's really interesting. And I really look forward to hearing more about that. David Potts, thank you.
Thank you, John.
Without it now, London would be unthinkable. Queues everywhere and aggro every time you change trains or buses. I'm talking about the London Travel Card, which was introduced in the 1980s. But believe it or not, despite having partly won an election on its transport policies, the Labour administration bought it in, had to fight hard to get it going. Dialect's Tony Gosling spoke to the man who introduced the public transport revolution to London.
I'm Dave Wetzel and got involved in the Labour Party through trade union activity. I was organising apprentices who worked for Wilkinson Sword, and through the industrial action as a kid of 17 I got involved with the Young Socialists and became a local councillor when I was 21. London Borough of Hounslow was the borough where I became a councillor, but after 2 years, 3 years, I realised being an engineer was not my forte, so I packed it in and became a bus conductor, which I really, really enjoyed. It was working fairly unsupervised. If you got on well with your driver, and you usually bought your driver a cup of tea each end of the route to make sure you did, he would give you a very, and it always was a he in those days, I'm back in 1962, would give you a very comfortable ride. I was just saying, I just got off a bus coming here, and I was just saying, think I used to walk around these buses collecting fares. But of course, the buses I walked around had smaller engines, so they couldn't accelerate so fast, and the brakes weren't much good either, so they slowed more gently, and consequently, I didn't break any legs doing it the way the drivers try and get us to break our legs now.
What was your first experience of in the Labour Party in Hounslow then?
I went to a Young Socialist meeting twice. They were weekly meetings, and on the second occasion they made me secretary of their branch, and 9 months later they made me the chair of West London Young Socialists. And with little experience I went round constituency Labour parties in the whole of West London telling them how to start Young Socialist branches. I always has been and still am a bit precocious.
How did you wind up as part of the Great London Council then?
Well, I was working as a political organiser for the London Co-op and organising 16 co-op party branches and demonstrations against the then Labour government under Wilson and then Callaghan.
That's a bit naughty, isn't it? Organising demonstrations against your own party.
Well, when your party's doing the wrong policies, like making cuts in education, health, and not supporting miners, and continuing with nuclear weapons, it's very easy to join the demonstrators. In fact, we used to organise the pickets, and we used to organise the stewards when there was a lobby of Parliament. And it was all very respectable, and I'd have to go and meet the Sergeant at Arms office, and I'd have to go into what was Old Scotland Yard and meet the ceremonials police. And we decided what sort of stewarding we needed to do on our side to try and avoid direct confrontation. And I met up with Ken Livingston. And a couple of years later, he said to me, I want you to stand for the Greater London Council, Dave. I said, you've got to be joking. They're all old fogies. They wear pinstripe suits. What have I got in common with them? He said, no, you don't realise. In 1981, we're going to have a revolution. We're going to take over the GLC for the left. So I said, well, as long as you promise me that's going to happen, I'll stand. And I got selected in Hammersmith. I beat Stephen Benn, lovely man, son of Tony Benn, and I beat a militant candidate to become the candidate for Hammersmith North. It was a Tory seat, and I really felt quite guilty because the old Tory councillor I replaced, He'd been to the local grammar school and been brought up there. He'd been mayor three times in the borough. So I felt a little bit guilty, me coming in from a neighbouring borough and kicking him out. But that's politics for you, and I've had some of that treatment myself now, thanks to Boris. So got elected. We used to have fringe meetings of the left before the election, and people like Paul Boateng, who ended up as the High Commissioner for Britain in South Africa, and Tony Banks, who was sports minister before he died. We were discussing what sort of role we would play. And because of my trade union background, I was hoping to be vice chair of the staff committee. But transport was always my second love in politics. My first is land reform. Come from a transport family. I've worked in transport in many different spheres, including running private lorries and rostering pilots for British Airways and various other jobs. And Tony Banks was going to be the chair of the transport committee. Anyway, the first meeting we had of our caucus after the election, on the day after the election, Tony Banks decided he wasn't going to do transport, he'd rather do arts. It was Valerie Wise. She was the daughter of Audrey Wise, the MP. She asked me, would I stand? And I said yes. And I beat the then deputy leader of the GLC Labour group by one vote. And that's the old right-wing Labour group, but he had joined the left caucus. We went on to do the chair of the fire brigade, and he challenged the result. He said it was a Ken had miscounted from the chair. So we voted again, and that time I beat him by three votes, so people could see which way the wind was blowing. But it was quite a daunting experience. I used to say that I'd been a councillor for 4 years in the London Borough of Hounslow, and it had always been right-wing controlled. I was considered to be so far left that they wouldn't even elect me as vice chair of the burials committee in case I went round the gravestones rousing the dead with Karl Marx. But I managed. It was a wonderful 5 years. We really enjoyed ourselves. There was ups and downs. The Fair's Fair thing was a big defeat in the courts. But we had a lot of successes as well.
When you came into the GLC, you could buy yourself a, I think it was called a Red Bus Rover, something to do many journeys on one day. But there was no such thing as a travel card. What was it that sort of drove you towards trying to get that implemented?
Well, the thing we inherited had graduated fares, which meant you had fare stages along the line of every bus route, along the railway lines, and the farther you travelled, the more you paid. And of course, that's not the best way to attract people to use public transport. We'd seen the French Carte Orange in Paris, and I've now met the person that actually introduced that to Paris. We thought it was a much better system to have zonal fares and one ticket that would take you on all modes of public transport.
That was former Chair of Transport at the Greater London Council, Dave Wetzel, with possibly some lessons to get Bristol's public transport working better. And next week, Dave tells us how, by reducing the fares on London's public transport, the total money collected actually increased, and there were thousands less serious accidents every year. Our next feature is by Anthea Page. It's part two of a recent car journey down the Shankill Road, Belfast, with a local man who we've chosen not to name for security reasons.
Shankill is always a great shopping route. People, you know, really enjoyed coming from other parts of Belfast to Shankill to shop. But like everything else, the government have thrown money at it. Here's a place used to be a picture house, now called the Spectrum Centre. And these are all, you know, it's the old attitude of government, which is the same in England and other parts. If there's a problem, you throw money at it. But money doesn't solve these social issues. I think it was Winston Churchill who said, the problem at the heart of man is the problem of man's heart. So you can't solve these issues by throwing money at them. We're now approaching West Belfast Orange Hall, the seat of number 9, District LOL. Just above it is a bar called the Northern Ireland Supporters Club. But on that site, what did exist before that bar was a bar called the Four Step Inn. And it was bombed, and a number of people were murdered in that bomb. Last week, they have arrested someone after 30-something years, and I think they're going to be charged with that participation in that bombing. This is the old Shankill graveyard to my right. A very old grave, one of the very oldest graveyards in Belfast, and no longer functional, hasn't functioned for many, many years. And we come up to Ainsworth Avenue here on this side, and Cambria Street on the other side, although locals call it Cambria Street. And this officially is the end of the Shankill Road, and what begins is the Woodvale Road, although generally speaking it's all called the Shankill area. We're also passing on my right, we find this. The conflict here has driven people back to their past, and they've raised the whole thing of the Somme again, and there's a Somme association now, and they've opened up a little garden of remembrance for those who died in the Somme in the First World War. We're passing St Matthew's Church now on my right. It's a unique church in an Anglican tradition, Church of Ireland that is. It is built in the shape of a shamrock. Now approaching Woodvale Park, which is one of the major parks in this part of Belfast.
Are there more kind of ethnic minorities moving into this area, like Chinese, Indians?
Not a great deal. There has been this tendency in what are commonly called loyalist areas of Belfast to reject people from foreign countries. And therefore there is more of a tendency to move them on.
Driving through a more affluent area now, aren't we? I would call this a middle-class suburb.
Well, it's coming up to be what was a middle-class suburb when I was growing up in this part of Belfast. But again, these houses have all changed. We're now approaching the Holy Cross Chapel on my right, which is commonly known in this area as Ardoyne. There's always conflict here when it comes to the issue of parades, which pass through this area of Belfast known as Ardoyne. Houses have been removed from here, the very top of the road at Twaddell Avenue side. We're approaching this Ardoyne area. There's an Orange Hall and a Protestant community north of Ardoyne, and they parade down here at various times of the year. This here over on my right now is 100% Catholic, so nationalist. They would oppose parades coming down here. The folks over on this side, Twaddell Avenue, would be largely loyalist, unionist, Protestant, and they would welcome those who parade down. So there is intercommunal conflict at this part of the road.
Would you say the Orange Parades caused a bit of conflict?
The cause of it or not is a matter of debate. It needs to be a bit of give and take on both sides.
Did the Catholics feel that the Orange Parades were causing the conflict? It's a bit in their face.
Yes, they make those allegations, yes.
But is there another side to that?
Well, yes, there's the question of civil rights, the right of people to parade on a public highway, the right of people to protest. These are all enshrined in British law and in the European human rights legislation. But obviously, no right is absolute. And therefore, an organisation has been formed like the Parades Commission, appointed by Her Majesty's loyal government to oversee that kind of thing, so that sometimes rights have to be restricted, because no right is absolute.
Could the Catholics have a parade?
Yes. But could they have a parade down the Shankill Road? Well, technically, legally, yes. But whether that right would have to be curtailed or not would be up to a decision that would have to be made when they would indicate that they wish to have a parade.
So this is Bordell Avenue?
Called after a man, Bordell, who was a businessman in Belfast, and he was actually murdered on his way to work by the IRA in the 1920s or 30s.
As far back as that?
Oh, yes. As far back as that. This is all now on my right, Ardoyne. This is the Ardoyne Road. There was the famous Holy Cross dispute up the top of this Ardoyne Road, the little road to my right. This is the Crumlin Road we're on.
So what happened at the dispute?
Well, the dispute at Ardoyne was that some of the loyalists who lived up there objected to people who brought their children to that school, because this was towards the end of the Troubles. People had been released from prison, etc., and some of those who were taking children to school were actually people who had been released from prison for murdering Protestants or murdering people, members of the security forces. And they thought that was a bit kind of in your face. They were being what some would call triumphalist. So we're continuing up the road now. The Crumlin takes you to the village at the end of the road.
That was part two of a feature about a recent car journey down the Shankill Road, Belfast, by Anthea Page. Next week in part three, we visit the Falls area of Belfast.
Last Sunday, due to technical difficulties, unfortunately some of you were unable to hear the last 20 minutes of the show. So for those of you who have been following Robert Louis Stevenson's exciting tale of pirates and buried gold, we are just going to repeat the very, very last ever part of Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island, read by Malcolm Grieve.
That was about our last doing on the island. Before that, we had got the treasure stowed and had shipped enough water and the remainder of the goat meat in case of any distress. And at last, one fine morning, we weighed anchor, which was about all that we could manage, and stood out of North Inlet, the same colours flying that the captain had flown and fought under at the palisade. Three fellows must have been watching us closer than we thought for, as we soon had proved. For, coming through the Narrows, we had to lie very near the southern point, and then we saw all three of them kneeling together on a spit of sand, with their arms raised in supplication. It went all to our hearts, I think, to leave them in that wretched state. But we could not risk another mutiny, and to take them home for the gibbet would have seemed a cruel sort of kindness. The doctor hailed them, and told them of the stores we had left, and where they were to find them. But they continued to call us by name, and appeal to us, for God's sake, to be merciful, and not to leave them to die in such a place. At last, seeing the ship still bore upon her course and was now drawing swiftly out of earshot, one of them, I know not which it was, leapt to his feet, and with a hoarse cry whipped his musket to his shoulder and sent a shot whistling over Silver's head and through the mainsail. After that, we kept under cover of the bulwarks. And when next I looked out, they had disappeared from the spit, and the spit itself had almost melted out of sight in a growing distance. That was, at least, the end of that, and before noon, to my inexpressible joy, the highest rock of Treasure Island, had sunk into the blue round of the sea. We were so short of men that everyone on board had to bear a hand, only the captain lying on a mattress in the stern and giving his orders, for though greatly recovered, he was still in want of quiet. We laid her head for the nearest port in Spanish America, for we could not risk the voyage home without fresh hands. And as it was, what with baffling winds and a couple of fresh gales, we were all worn out before we reached it. It was just at sundown when we cast anchor in a most beautiful and landlocked gulf, and were immediately surrounded by shore boats full of Negroes and Mexican Indians and half-bloods selling fruits and vegetables and offering to dive for bits of money. The sight of so many good-humoured faces, especially the blacks, the taste of the tropical fruits, and above all, the lights that began to shine in the town, made a most charming contrast to our dark and bloody sojourn on the island, and the doctor and the squire, taking me along with them, went ashore to pass the early part of the night. Here they met the captain of an English man of war, fell in talk with him, went on board his ship, and in short had so agreeable a time that day was breaking when we came alongside the Hispaniola. Ben Gunn was on deck alone, and as soon as we came on board he began with wonderful contortions to make us a confession. Silver was gone. The Maroon had connived in his escape in a shore boat some hours ago, and he now assured us that he had only done so to preserve our lives, which would certainly have been forfeit if that man with the one leg had stayed aboard. But this was not all. The sea cook had not gone empty-handed. He had cut through a bulkhead unobserved and had removed one of the sacks of coin worth perhaps 300 or 400 guineas to help him on his further wanderings. I think we were all pleased to be so cheaply quit of him. Well, to make a long story short, we got a few hands on board, made a good cruise home, and the Hispaniola reached Bristol just as Mr. Blandy was beginning to think of fitting out her consort. 5 men only of those who sailed returned with her. Drink and the devil had done for the rest, with a vengeance. Although, to be sure, we were not in quite so bad a case as that other ship they sang about. With 1 man of her crew alive, what put to sea with 75. All of us had an ample share of the treasure, and used it wisely or foolishly according to their natures. Captain Smollett is now retired from the sea. Grey not only saved his money, but being suddenly smit with the desire to rise, also studied his profession, and he is now mate and part owner of a fine, full-rigged ship, married besides, and the father of a family. As for Ben Gunn, he got £1,000, which he spent or lost in 3 weeks, or to be more exact, in 19 days, for he was back begging on the 20th. Then he was given a lodge to keep, exactly as he had feared upon the island, and he still lives, a great favourite, though something of a butt, with the country boys, and a notable singer in church on Sundays and Saints' Days. Of Silver we have heard no more. That formidable seafaring man with one leg has at last gone clean out of my life. But I dare say he met his old negress, and perhaps still lives in comfort with her and Captain Flint. It is to be hoped so, I suppose, for his chances of comfort in another world are small. The bar Silver and the arms still lie, for all that I know, where Flint buried them, and certainly they shall lie there for me. Oxen and wain ropes would not bring me back again to that accursed island. And the worst dreams that I ever have are when I hear the surf booming about its coasts, or start upright in bed with the sharp voice of Captain Flint ringing in my ears. Pieces of 8. Pieces of 8.
That was the very final part of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson, read by Malcolm Grieve. Just for those of you who missed it last week due to technical difficulties. We are expecting to have a new serial in the coming weeks.
It's a pleasure for Poetry to introduce Rosemary Dunn. Hello.
Hello there. Pleasure to be here.
Okay, you've had some football sort of themed stuff before and various other stuff.
I have, and I've written another topical poem, and it's about Engelbert Humperdinck.
Brilliant.
As the choice for Eurovision. So yes, I wrote this in a day, so I'm quite proud of that, although it might show. So here we go. Engelbert does Eurovision. Who will come to the rescue? Dear old Blighty is in trouble. All of Europe hates our singing and our little Britain bubble. It's enough to drive past winner Sir Cliff Richard to hard drink. Fear not, Auntie Beebe has pointed her finger at Engelbert Humperdinck. Yes, Engelbert, Engelbert, the hopes of GB rest on you. Oh, Engelbert, just do better than boy band Blue. He's the man who brought the Tom Jones to the sideburns on his face. Like Virgil from TV's Thunderbirds, can he rock it up to first place? They hope so. Yes, he's a 75-year-old Vegas crooner. Call him the Hump, don't call him the Hoff. Paul Gambaccini asserts he has the swoon factor. His Euro fan base won't see him booed off. So, Engelbert, dear Engelbert, more orange than a tango. Forget he's a 60s Herbert singing quando, quando, quando. Yet, there was a time he kept the Beatles from number one on the top of the pop's charts with his mellow last waltz song twanging the G-strings of Randy Granny's hearts. He's good at darts. I made that up. He's largely made of cheese. Well, he does come from Leicester, a mate of Charlton Heston and the Bee Gees. A nation's fate rests with menopausal women who crave an Engelbert Humperdinck booty call by pinning our hopes on Please Release Me via James Blunt's You're Beautiful. Yes, somewhere in the dungeons of Auntie's creative artists and writers' base, their hoping crappy mellifluous chorus will save our collective face. He's not the Hoff. He's the Hump, has sold gazillions across the continent. I've heard he's quite a grump. Fingers crossed, he's not incontinent. So when he takes the floor at Azerbaijan with his Ron Seal-coloured LA fried tan, how will this veteran fare with his rock-hard hairsprayed hair against Europop spandex frockers and Norwegian head-banging goth rockers? He's our last hope against Jedward, those prize twin Irish numpties. They can't pronounce his name. They say it sounds like Humpty Dumpties. So come on, there's no denying old Hump is pretty dashing. The time is here, UK, to give them Euros a right good thrashing. Cheer on our Engelbert of Humperdinck, a choice either brilliant or downright queer. He could take us to the brink. He could. He could really triumph this year. But wait. Euros are still smarting from David Cameron's taunts while he's busy growling, veto. They're bringing out their null points. Yes. David Cameron thinks he wags the dog, but he's a toothless bulldog cur. Europe prepares to vote. Bog off. Oh, well, there's always next year.
Rosemary Dunn, thank you very much.
Thank you.
On the 23rd of June, 1839, there was a vast dilapidated monastery on top of a hill in Lebanon, and inside there was an old lady dying. The room was filthy, bare of everything except a pallet bed, and she was utterly alone. This lady was Lady Hester Stanhope, descended from two of the most aristocratic families of the age, and whose brilliance, bravery, and wit had earned her an extraordinary reputation. As the niece of William Pitt, Lady Hester had become the toast of London society. After Pitt died, she left England to travel to the East, where no European woman had ever travelled before alone, and she quickly gathered such power and reputation that not one European leader had succeeded in standing against her. As a result of her daring expeditions into the desert and her friendship with the Bedouin Arabs, she quickly became known as the Queen of the Desert. People travelled great distances to meet her to ask for her help and her charity. Nearly 30 years later, she was deeply in debt, deserted by her family, her friends and her country. She resigned her British citizenship and walled herself up in her mountain home. Finally, as her servants deserted her, taking her last few possessions, she died. This is an extract from a book by Virginia Childs about her travels in Syria.
Lady Hester Stanhope's arrival in Syria. Tel Aviv is a major city on the coast of Israel, but when Lady Hester landed there it was simply the pretty stone town of Jaffa. Easter was just over and the narrow sloping streets are bustling with people from every Eastern country and religion, many of them pilgrims returning home from Jerusalem. Traders throughout the Lebanon took advantage of this yearly passage of pilgrims to bring their goods to trade and barter. Silks from Damascus, Barbary shawls and the softest cloth from Angora were exchanged for pearls, precious stones, gums, herbs and medicines. The teeming market town was a microcosm of what has long been known as the Holy Lands. Situated as it is, a long rectangle of land bounded by the Mediterranean on the west and mountains and desert on the east, the history of the area reads like one long list of foreign invasions. It has always been of vital geographic importance. The isthmus that joins Eastern Europe to Africa and the Mediterranean countries to those of the Middle East. Armies have invaded, conquered, been defeated and left. Boundaries have moved and place names changed. As part of the vast Ottoman Empire that stretched all around the Eastern Mediterranean from Romania to Morocco, it had no specific internal boundaries in the early 19th century and encompassed the present-day states of Syria, Lebanon, Jordan and Israel. As well as being known as the Holy Lands, it was also called the Levant, or Greater Syria. But whatever its name, it was part of a continent almost wholly unexplored by Europeans. Lady Hester was going into what was largely unknown territory. Of all the thousands of people packed into Jaffa that May, none was more polygenous than the British agent Signor Damiani, who came rushing down to the port to greet Lady Hester. Born in Syria of Italian parents, his father had served in the English Navy, and he now bade Lady Hester welcome to the Levant on behalf of her country. He presented an extraordinary figure as he stood on the quay. He wore a long Turkish jalaba, a garment rather like an ordinary shirt extended to the ground. But instead of the usual turban, his long grey hair was tied back in a thick pigtail, on top of which was perched an ancient cocked hat. He was intent on providing hospitality for Lady Hester and her party, impressing upon her rather too many times for subtlety that she should not give him too large a present. She had decided to visit Jerusalem, however, and despite Damiani's blandishments, stayed in Jaffa only long enough to assemble enough servants and transport to make the journey. The party was completely reprovisioned by now after the shipwreck, and so there was a lot of luggage. Traditionally, asses were used as beasts of burden for short trips, and camels for longer journeys. Hester had no less than 10 camels laden with tents, marquees, clothes, provisions and gifts, and numerous donkeys and horses to carry herself and her party. Two Mameluke servants given to Lady Hester as a parting gift for Mehmet Ali were joined by 8 Syrians, and the governor of Jaffa had provided 2 bodyguards for the party, for travel of any kind in Syria was dangerous. It is hard for us to realise fully quite how daring it was for Lady Hester to be travelling into Syria. Europeans had journeyed there before, but comparatively few of them, and all of them men. Gertrude Bell, who was so admired for her travels throughout Syria and Arabia, did not set out until nearly 100 years later. Lady Hester had died an old woman, 30 years before Bell was born. Apart from the inherent dangers for a woman travelling in an unknown country, there were differences and difficulties almost impossible to imagine. One fact that perhaps brings this into focus was that when Lady Hester travelled in Syria, there were no roads and no wheeled vehicles. All travel was done by foot, or on horses, donkeys, or camels. The roads that had been established in biblical times had fallen into complete disrepair over the centuries, owing to lack of coherent policy from Constantinople. Therefore, all carts and wagons had become useless, and were no longer even made. It was a different world. Travel was difficult and dangerous for other reasons as well. The Ottoman Empire was so vast that direct government from Constantinople was impossible, so some kind of local rule was necessary. Each area had its own governor, who was allowed complete autonomy, unless, as frequently happened, they became too corrupt or too ambitious. Constantinople would then step in, often appointing the brother or son of the existing governor in his place, and leaving the protagonists literally to fight it out between them. One set of travel documents was not enough when travelling between these different regions. New negotiations had to be made every time. The many mountainous areas throughout the length and breadth of the country were impossible for any governor to control, however efficient or fierce he was, and so they provided refuge for all those who either could not or would not submit to the local rule. Recalcitrant ex-rulers, persecuted tribes and assorted brigands and villains all managed a healthy existence in the mountains, swooping down on unsuspecting travellers to augment their meagre income. Bodyguards were not a luxury but a necessity for any party of substance that intended to travel through these desolate areas.
That was Malcolm Grieve reading part one from Lady Hester Stanhope, Queen of the Desert by Virginia Childs. And next week, you can hear part two. It's my pleasure to introduce Jeff Sparks for this week's What's On.
Thank you. Hello, this is your What's On guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday 23rd of March, Clumsy will be performing with support from the Detouras at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £4 in advance and £5 on the door, and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Also on 23rd of March, Three Kings High will be performing with support from Drew Bag at Mr. Wolf's in St. Stephen Street, Bristol. Entry is £3 on the door and doors open at 8 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Bob Dylan. His career has spanned over 50 years, and in those years he has released 34 studio albums and 13 live albums, along with numerous singles and compilation albums. This is from the album Love and Theft, which was released in 2001, and is a song titled Moonlight.
They are turning and my sad heart is yearning to hear again the songbird's sweet melodious tone. Won't you meet me out in the moonlight all along? The dusky light, the day is losing orchids, poppies, black-eyed Susan, the earth and sky that melts with flesh and bone. Won't you meet me out in the moonlight alone? The air is thick and heavy all along the levee where the geese into the countryside have flown. Won't you meet me out in the moonlight alone? Well, I'm preaching peace and harmony, the blessings of tranquility. Yet I know when the time is right to strike. I take you across the river, dear, you no need to linger here. I know the kinds of things you like. The clouds are turning crimson, the leaves fall from the limbs, the branches cast their shadows on the stone. Won't you meet me out in the moonlight alone? The boulevards of cypress trees, the masquerade of birds and bees, the petals pink and white, the wind has blown. Won't you meet me out in the moonlight alone? Trailing moss and mystic glow, the purple blossom soft as snow, my tears keep flowing to the sea. Doctor, lawyer, Indian chief, it takes a thief to catch a thief. Well, whom does the bell toll for love? It tolls for you and me. All pulses run into my palm, the sharp hills are rising from yellow fields with twisted oaks that grow. Whoa.
That was Bob Dylan with Moonlight from the album Love and Theft, which was released in 2001. For more information, you can check out www.bobdylan.com. Into Saturday 24th of March, rockabilly group Jackrabbit Slim will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Tickets are £8 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Finally, on Sunday 25th of March, Gemma Hayes will be performing with support from Boat to Row at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Take care and goodbye to you, Jeff.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Sunday. That's at 2 p.m. We're also broadcast on Preston FM and in St Albans on Radio Verulam.
If you're outside Bristol and on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, and this will remind you every Thursday when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from our website, dialectsradio.co.uk.
Thank you to our studio guests, David Parks and Rosemary Dunn. Reporters this week were Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. And we also had Malcolm Grieve read us part from the diary of Lady Stanhope. Studio production this week was by Michael Noyce, and the producer was Tony Gosling.
Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, please contact us through Volunteering Bristol, as has happened very recently today, in fact, on 0117 989 7733, which you can find on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. As promised earlier in the show, here's the number again for Bristol Bullywatch Helpline, 01454 318 753.
That was Dialect. I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman.
Wishing you a very good week from all the team at Queen Square Studios in Bristol City Centre. Thank you for listening, and until the next time, goodbye.
To me, meet me down by the gallows tree, for it's sad news I bring about this old town and all that it's offering. Some say troubles abound. Someday soon they're gonna pull the old town down. One day we'll return here when the Belfast child sings again. Brothers, sisters, where are you now? As I look for you right through the crowd. All my life here I've spent with my faith in God and church and the government. Some say troubles abound. Someday soon they're gonna pull the old town down. One day we'll return here when the Belfast child sings again. When the Belfast child sings again. when the Belfast child sings again. When the Belfast child sings again.